The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What I'd like to try and accomplish today is just the first chapter one. Just a brief understanding of Koheles and just a little introduction. Koheles is referred to in English as Ecclesiastes. And comes from the word, or the root is connected to eclectic, eclectic, which means very collective, all-embracing, all-encompassing. And Koheles is the name of the author. And the reason why that's the name of the author is because of two reasons offered, that he was an eclectic person, well-versed in all wisdoms, and as well as from the word kahal, which means a congregation, which means that Koheles was a person who was eclectic in what he knew and eclectic in his ability to relate to the collective people. And who is this man Koheles? King Solomon, the son of King David, who really actually built the temple, built the first temple. King Solomon, according to our tradition, wrote three books. When he was a child, very young, he wrote the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. But when he was somewhere midlife, he wrote Mishlei, Proverbs. And when he was an old man, he wrote Koheles, Ecclesiastes. And so when you read this, you have to try and imagine you're reading the works of a person nearing the end of their lives. Now, the Talmud in the book, in the tractate Shabbat, page 30, side 2, you know, in the Talmud, you get one page but two sides, right? In the normal books, each side has its own number, not in the Talmud. A page has a number, and then this side, the A side, the side. The rabbis thought of basically hiding. I don't know the word hiding. Well, hide and seek. They were basically thought of concealing the book of Koheles, because there's so much in this book that is apparently heretical. King Solomon says very, very shocking statements. And anybody who would read this would find it full of contradictions and paradoxes and struggles. And so the rabbis initially did think that it was a book that was not befitting to be available, okay? And they thought they would simply just have it concealed. But they decided not to do that, because ultimately the faith of King Solomon comes shining through, at least by the end of the book, where he says all that there is to life is to have reverence of God and do the mitzvah. So no matter how much his struggle might be, and no matter how many doubts he seems to share with us, and how many complexities and apparent heretical statements, his faith is still unwavering. And that's a very interesting idea, that a person of faith can still have that faith, and yet, within the context of their faith, still have tremendous amount of struggles, tremendous amount of questions, ups and downs. And so Koheles was therefore canonized into the Tanakh. Now, Koheles is the struggle of life. And I find Koheles just such a fascinating piece And the reason why it's so beautiful is because I think King Solomon relates to us. Okay? He relates to us. And that's why he's called Kohelet. Because he's a man that has gathered many wisdoms, and he's a man that speaks to the people. Okay? And that is part of the problem with educators today. They might have brilliant ideas, but to find educators that speak to the people, know where the people are at, right, and can acknowledge their pain, right, and voice their pain, and give voice to their pain, and then struggle with it and attempt to deal with it, that's truly a unique person. And that was Kohelet, that was King Solomon. Okay, so that's just a little introduction to it. Now what I'd like you to do for the next 20 minutes on your own, read chapter 1, okay? Of course, first read chapter 1, but then rip it apart, ask your questions. Really, very carefully, with a fine-tooth comb, go through the verses and struggle with his meaning. What is his message? What is his struggle? Right? What is his resolve? All right? And so that should certainly 20 minutes to even, perhaps even more. But with the person beside you as a chavruta, struggle with it. Try and understand what his point. Okay? Try and conceptualize each verse or the movement of each verse. Okay? And then we'll do it together. Okay, let's read inside. Try and follow in the Hebrew. I'm going to translate it as literally as I can. Alright? Divrei Kohelet, the words of Kohelet, Ben David, the son of David, Melech Yerushalayim, the king in Jerusalem. The words of Kohelet, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. So this first sentence does what for us? Tells us who our author is. Who's speaking to us. And who is speaking to us? I'm not asking technically and conceptually. Who is this that's saying these words? Because, you know, it's one thing to read a book, but then you find out who said it. Okay? That makes a big difference. You know, if I were to say this, or some drunk were to say this, or, you know, so, okay, I understand why he would say anything like this. But you know who's about to say this? Right? It's Kohelet. An eclectic person, a Renaissance man, a person who had a total embrace of all wisdoms. He's coming from a good home. You know what I mean? He's not the son of nobody. He's the son of King David, no more, no less. I mean, you're talking about the son of King David, and he made it in the world. You know what I mean? He made it in the world. He's the king. He was the king of Yerushalayim, which was considered to be the center of the world. Okay? So that really, really makes a difference. When you find out that the son of King David, the wisest of all persons, the person who's got such an embrace on wisdoms and had such a position of status and in such a place of status, and when he says a thing like this, which he's about to say, vain, vain, Amar Kohelet, Kohelet said, all is vain, all is futile, then you're really surprised. You see, if you're sitting in a park, you know, on a park bench, you sit there. I was in Central Park. It was Friday afternoon, so I was taking a walk in Central Park, and I saw this guy walking around, and he's got a bag on his head. Okay, he wears this bag, this paper bag on his head, and walks around with a dish, with a bell, and on the top of this brass-looking bell is a horse. And he walks around. He comes up to people and says, "You know, a dollar for your wish." Okay? And he goes there, and so I was watching this guy, and he fascinates me, you know, fascinates me. So I see him, and he's sitting there on a park bench, so I sit down beside him. I say, "Hi, what's your name?" He said, "My name is," I think he called himself, Prophet M. I think he calls himself Prophet M. And he's been doing this, he's been walking Central Park for, I think he's 25, 30 years already. He walks around, he makes his living by having people ring this bell. He's got a shtick, he says, you know, hold, you close your eyes, ring a bell, make a wish, and don't tell mama. This is what he's been doing for 30 years. And so I said, this is a fascinating guy. I want to sit and talk to him. And so, you know, you get into these philosophical discussions with the man in the park, on a park bench. Okay, you know, say life is this, miserable, rotten, futile. Well, okay, you know, you don't expect too much more from a guy like this who really has had a very rough, terrible life, abandoned by his parents, never made it in the world. You know, okay, so you can understand a person saying, Havo Havalim, Hakol Havo Havalim, you know, it's all vain, it's all futile, it's all worthless, it's all nothing, it's all vapor. You understand a person like that saying something like that. And it doesn't really register much in our souls because we only expect that from them. But we wouldn't expect the words of Kohelis, the son of David, the king of Yerushalayim, to say something like this. Okay? And that's why this has such an impact on us. That such a person could either say this, or perhaps he's really not saying this, but he's voicing and acknowledging that this is something that people do say. This is after he's looking back at it all. And in fact, the Targum, the translator, also points out that he saw prophetically what was going to happen to the kingdom that he and his father worked so hard to build, how Yerubbaal was going to split the kingdom. And he looked at everything that he had put his life into and then realized, my gosh, that in the future it'll all be gone. Okay? So this is near the end of his life, and this is viewed as after the Talmud says in Sanhedrin that originally Solomon was the king of the world. And then he was the king of Israel. And then he was the king of Jerusalem. And then he was nothing. Right? Then he was nothing. And so he had his ups and then his downs. The Talmud says that he was, you know, a head yoke, a simple person. Then he was a king, and then he was a head yoke. He was a poor person. Then he was a rich person. Then he was a poor person. And so he really went through the life cycle that everybody could relate to. And that's, you know, that's one of the, you know, what I love about Kohelis is people have this vision of rabbis to have their life together, that everything's so worked out, so everything's so clear. Remember, I read an introduction of a book by a guy named Alan Watts. It was viewed by many people in the New Age, you know, big spiritual guru. And he said, you know, people need to believe in a guru, in a person who's got life all worked out. And he said, and the job of the guru is to allow the people to believe that what they want to believe in him is exactly what he is when he isn't. Okay? And people don't see the reality side. You know, and that's what's so refreshing to see. You know, rather than the rabbi come off like he's got it all worked out, but that what's really worked out is that he doesn't have it all worked out, and that he's ready to struggle with life. And that's what's so refreshing about King Solomon over here. That he is, I feel he's very straightforward with us. And I think that he's not painting images of a wonderful, easy life. Even for someone like King Solomon, you know, this is what he could feel. And I, you know, this is part of the problems with biographies of rabbis today. You know, you have these biographies of rabbis today, and they were born a tzaddik, righteous. They knew all of Shas by the time they were 13, and they were just unbelievable righteous by the time they were, you know, 15. And you don't see anything about this righteous person, this Talmid Chacham, that seems real. He doesn't seem like a model that I can really relate to, because, you know, my gosh, he had it all worked out when he was born already, so he can't be my teacher, right? The only person that can teach me about what it means to be happy is a person who really knows what it means to be depressed, because if you don't know what it means to be depressed, you don't know what it means to be happy. Only person to tell me what the meaning of life is the person who's really struggled with feeling or coming to a point where they thought themselves that life was meaningless. But when you read some of these biographies today of some of the rabbis, you know, there's this attempt to make their lives so simple and so wonderful and so worked out then instead of what they hope to do with these books, which is to be a biography of a model of a person, this is not helping me. You know, I wasn't born to a family. You know, I wasn't born to King David. You know what I mean? So surely, if I was born to King David, I'd be that way. Right? But you see, a man who was born to King David, and he made mistakes, and he did struggle. And you see this more and more, and I remember I heard a tape by Rabbi Beryl Wine about the life of the Chafetz Chaim. And he said, you know, people don't realize the life of the Chafetz Chaim when you read some of these books. Said people don't know that the Chafetz Chaim went through a period of depression, right? And through his period of depression, he realized that it was actually his eating habits, and therefore the Chafetz Chaim became very careful with eating and used to always tell the students, get 8 hours of sleep. Now, when I heard that, the Chafetz Chaim was real. You know, when I heard that, I want to read the Chafetz Chaim. But to hear the words of a person who never struggled. And he said the Chafetz Chaim was known to have a problem with anger. Chafetz Chaim, you know, you almost feel heretical saying that Chafetz Chaim, the great Chafetz Chaim, had a problem with anger. You know, we don't see that in the Bible. The Bible tells us that Moses lost his temper. But all of a sudden, in modern biographies of rabbis, all of a sudden, they're all just so worked out, everything's so wonderful. And this is, to a certain extent, I think, the influence of the exile, and somewhat the influence of the Christian world, that's something called the saint. And these people had it always put together. And it's just not true, and it's really unfortunate. It's really unfortunate not to know that the greatest of the greatest had their times too. And that's what made them great. You know, that's what made them great, is because they did have their struggles, and they did have their pains, and they did have their sufferings, and they did have their doubts. And yet a person of faith is not a person who never doubted. A person of faith is a person who had real doubts and overcame their faith, overcame their doubt. You know, you look at a person, you say they're courageous, right? Because they ran into the battlefield and they started shooting. And what a courageous person is not courageous. They're probably just crazy. You know, so a person runs in the middle of battle, saves the whole platoon. You say, what a courageous person. But maybe he didn't have a notion of fear. But a person has a notion of fear, right? And overcomes it, that's courage. Right? And only a person who has a real encounter with confusion and overcomes it, and sometimes even just lives with it, only such a person really has their act together. And that's what's so exciting about reading Koheles. Divrei Koheles, Ben David, Melech B'Yushalayim, you know, and yet such a person can acknowledge, can empathize, can give voice, and maybe even himself experience this, and say, Havel Havalim, vain of vanities, Amar Koheles, Koheles said, Havel Havalim Hakol Hevel. He's got seven pebbles over here, because double havalim, vanities, is at least two. And so havel is one, havalim is two, which is three. Havel is four, havalim is five, six, and the last havel is seven. And the Midrash says, all 6 days of creation. It's all futile. It's all futile. It's all worthless. People have had those experiences when you look around, and it all just seems so meaningless. Hakol. Hakol hafel. Now what is hafel anyways? What does the word hefel mean? Worthless, futile, you know? Worthless means it really has no past to it. What was, you know, look at its past, what was it? Futile means it really has no future. But hefel, as we learned in the Chumash, what does hefel literally mean? What does hevel literally mean? Vapor. Right. Hevel is a vapor. A hevel is your breath in a wintry day. And what happens to your breath in a wintry day? It's gone. It has no substance. It has no permanence. It's just so transient. It looks like spirit. You know, it reminds me of these commercials, Coca-Cola commercials, you know, Coca-Cola, you know, life, you're out there on the beach, and it's a beautiful beach, and there's not one piece of dirt on the beach, you know, because we're drinking Coca-Cola,
NOC is so wonderful, you know, and this woman comes out of the middle of the sea, she's holding these two Cokes, you know, that she purchased at the bottom of the sea, and she runs out, everything's so exciting, it's the Coke, and then they come out, they pull out of their bikini pocket, you know, a bottle opener, and they open it up, and again, Charlie, get a close-up on the, what do you see coming out of this bottle? Heaven. Right? That's what comes out, this vapor. It comes out of the bottle. It looks like a genie. It looks like some spirit, you know? And then they take the Coke and they drink it. There's this silhouette as the sun bursts behind them and they're drinking the Coke and they dance around singing, Im yesh Coca-Cola, yesh chayim. If you have life, you have Coke. You have Coke, you have life. But you know what it is? You open the bottle and you hear that. It's gone. And it ends up in a belch. That's what it is. It's a belch. That's what it is. And that's Hevel. And you know, you couldn't be more graphic than that. You look at life and it just basically looking at it, just look like a puff. It's gone. And it's not one puff, it's seven puffs. It's gone. Ma yitaron la'adam. You know, it's like fireworks. That's, you know, like, that's what I love about fireworks. And I was looking at it. Ooh. Ah. It's gone. It's just gone. Ma yitaron la'adam. What advantage? Yitaron. What profit? What extra is there to la'adam? B'chol amalo. In all his labors. And he's looking at it and with what the Targum is telling us that he saw prophetically that this kingdom that he worked so hard to build is ultimately going to be split and destroyed, exile. So you say to yourself, what's the point to build in order for it just to be destroyed? What all the labor I put into it. My yitaron la'adam b'chol amaloshi amol tachat Hashem. What then, what will I get from all this? You know, and we have these moments. I think we all have this moment where we look at life with a total eye of objectivity and we say, my gosh, you know, you're in the midst of you know, that greatest deal that you've been working on. And then all of a sudden you have this moment of realization that it will pass too and it will be nothing ultimately also. And we've all had those moments. Right? And Shlomo also had that moment. Right? And gives voice to those moments of reflection where you look at it all and it just seems so worthless, futile, meaningless, so transient. Nothing to grab onto in the end. I look back at it all and I say, what do I have? What do I really have? And I remember I did this fundraiser in the home of a multi-millionaire. And this is a spectacular home. I mean, this is something outrageous. And so I'm giving the class, and I was really excited because I got myself into the door, and they hosted a parlor meeting, and I, you know, of course, my major concern was the owner of the home. I was hoping that I would somehow inspire him and hopefully realize, you know, that I'm doing something, please support it. Anyways, it was one of the most disturbing lectures I ever gave in my life, because this man who I had somewhat of an eye for couldn't sit still. He just couldn't sit still. You know, he would sit, he would get up, he would move, he would be at the back of the room, at the front of the room, and I go, what is wrong with this guy? You know? And really you saw that the man had no tranquility in his life. You walk into the house, you see a palace. Right? You see an environment that would apparently be just so, I mean, you say to yourself, this is a good life. You know, what more could this guy want? And yet, the guy is a tormented soul. He just can't sit. He can't never. Right? Well, I finished my class, and I give a little pitch about, you know, Israel life, raising money for it, and everything like that. And there's a group of people standing around and talking, and he dramatically comes in the middle of my discussion with these people and taking one of my brochures with a check sticking out of it, he dramatically puts it, and he says, Rabbi here! And he really, literally interrupts the conversation with that. And I was embarrassed, you know what I mean? Thank you very much for those inspiring words. I mean, I know the guy didn't hear a word of it because he wasn't around for most of it. And it's just the pomp and the arrogance. And so then I hear these people talking, and they say, I forget the guy's name, they say, oh, I see you put in your new swimming pools. Yes, well, how much did it cost? He said, I figure that if I swim in it every single day, right, and I do about, you know, 10 lengths a day, and I calculate that over a period of 10 years, I figure out that every stroke I take is costing me a buck. Now I say to yourself, my gosh, enjoy that swimming pool, you know? Well, $1, $2, $3. Yeah, I was amazed, but you know, this is, and so, you know, thank you very much, and I had a lift to where I was staying, and as I'm saying goodbye to him, he says, well, thank you very much, Rabbi, and he walks down the street in the middle of the rain, right, and he's not wearing a coat, and I'm in the car, and the woman who helped me set this up, and taking me to where I'm staying, she says, the poor man. Like, do you understand the poor man? I mean, it was just an imaginary, you know, multi-million dollar building and this swimming thing that costs him a buck every time he, you know. And he walks out of his house, down the street, in the rain. And she says, the poor man, he hardly sleeps at night. And look at him, he's rocking in the rain. You know? And so imagine the king, and everybody thinks he's got it worked out. And then one night to see him in the middle of the night, you know, in his pajamas walking in the rain. My eternal Adam b'cholam Allah, what do I get out of all this? What really am I going to hold on to? I see the figures increasing in my bank account. I see the property around me. I see, what am I really gaining? She'amol tachat ha'shamayim. Now, it's here that you begin to hear the real secret of what Kohelis is saying. He's talking about mitachat Hashem. What do I get under the sun? I'm talking about the under the sun world. Right? And he says under the sun, I think it's, yeah, it's 29 times in the entire book. And this is what he's talking about. Right? So he's going to get to the meaning, but he's saying, under the sun, if your whole vision is only that which is under the sun, well then it's really havel havelim, it's all really vain, it's all really vanity, it's all really futile. Because under the sun, now what does under the sun represent? What does under the sun represent? Well, it represents the natural world. The world under the sun. I'm not talking about the world beyond the sun. But if my whole context of living is only the natural world, only the physical world, only the world of time and space and nature, then these are the conclusions I think most people either have drawn or will eventually draw. Because when you look at the world in the light of the sun, in the light of time, in the light of space, in the light of nature, in the light of the physical, in the physical light, then what really do we have? What really do we have? The Kabbalah talks about every time I do a mitzvah, I increase the divine light in the world. I always try to understand what that means. It sounds so metaphysical, you know, turning on the light, turning up the light, adding light, you know, what does it mean? And I finally understood it when I was teaching a class in a Hillel in Philadelphia. And I saw this book on the shelf in the Hillel office. It was called, When You Say God, What Do You Mean? And, what an interesting book, When You Say God, What Do You Mean? And I was reading through it, and I found it really fascinating. The Hillel director said to me, that if I like it, I could have it because nobody even reads most of these books here, which is quite sad. So she gave me the book, which was really nice. And in this book, this is a woman who traveled the world and interviewed every kind of person from all walks of life, religion, philosophies. When you say God, what do you mean? That's a very important thing, you know? I mean, that's like the beginning of the beginnings. And so there was one statement there that I found to be the most profound. And it was, this was the answer. God for me is like the light in my bedroom. When I turn it on, it lets me see what's there. Right? Now, the author of that statement was a girl who was 5 years old. Right? But such wisdom from the mouth of babes. When I read that, all of a sudden I realized what the Kabbalah was talking about, the light of God. What does it mean, the light of God? There are many lights that we have available to view the world under. We could use the light of science. And if I look at the world in the light of science, right, in the light of science, what does the world look like in the light of science? Well, I see. I look at a tree, you know, I take out of my pocket my scientific light and shine it on those leaves. What do I see? Protoplasm, I don't know what, you know. Okay, that's what I see. What do I see in the light of science? What I see in the light of science is a statement I once shared with you from a scientist by the name of Eddington, who in his book wrote that if we were to fill all of Grand Central Station with dust, one speck of dust is planet Earth. Scientifically, if you look at the world scientifically, then the world is one just one speck. And if each and every one of us in this world, there are 5 billion people in this world, that means that each and every one of us is really just 1/5 billionth of a speck of dust. Songs like Dust in the Wind is very optimistic. What they should have said is we're 1/5 billionth of a speck of dust. But, you know, they said, it didn't work, no one will notice. Let's give it to them. We'll be nice, you're Dust in the Wind. But that's it. When you look at the world, right, in the light of science, then you're worth less than 99 cents of chemicals in the light of science. And when you look at the world under the light of the sun, which is the light of science, which is the light of the material, in the light of the physical, in the light of nature. So then what do I see in the light of nature? What do I really see in the light of time? In the light of space? Right? When I look at my life, I say, so what did I really accomplish? I thought I was gonna reach the moon. What did I really, you know, it basically is a Harry Chapin song. You know, he took off for the footlights and I took off for the sky. That's it, you know. And so what do I see? Yitaron, what did I really benefit? You know, what I really gain, and you hear it more and more, these wealthy people coming and looking at all their wealth, and they had such a vision, and they had such a challenge. And then they look back at it all, and they say, you know, what did I really gain? What profit did I really have from all of this? And you say to yourself, oh gosh. I mean, you can understand a person who's poor saying, oh, money's worthless. Where did it really get me? Where did I get to? But when you hear a wealthy person and you hear songs like Richard Corey, which is probably dating myself, you know, of Simon Garfunkel, which is, you know, the man who was wealthy and had it all and then killed himself. Now you can understand why people feel that way. And the reason why they feel that way is because the only light that they're using to view their lives is the natural light. In the light of nature, in the light of time, in the light of science, in the light of the material. Dor Holech. The Dorba, a generation goes and a generation comes. Va'aretz lo olam omedet. A generation goes. You know, a whole history, you know. It's like, I love it. You pick up these history books and you see hundreds of years in one page. And you turn it. And you say to yourself, is that life? You know. And often I think of these presidents, I always think, you know, when President Clinton was voted, I said, wow, he must feel great. But 4 years later, what will be, you know what I mean? You were the tops. You were the tops. In fact, I think there was once a president. They have a law in America that the president has to, if a person was a president, then they have to make a certain amount of money for the rest of their lives every year, because there actually was a president, I don't remember who, I'm not American, you know, Canadian wouldn't remember prime ministers either, right? That there was a president who actually went on welfare a couple of years later, you know, and it was just such a bouchard, it was such an embarrassment to the American people that the president should all of a sudden be on welfare. And so they're, you know, so they don't want people to think that could ever happen, right? But that's what you should think that could happen, right? Don't hide it, it's true. That's what could happen. You could be the president. You could be begging on the street, right? You could see, oh, wow, this is the new generation, you know? Wow, we're the new generation. New generation. Flip the page. And I remember it was Yom Kippur. And you know, on Yom Kippur, you bow down on the floor, and you know, at the bow on the floor itself, so people bring newspaper, right? So you have all these newspaper, old newspapers that were collected so people could bow down. So we were walking out of, we finished the Yom Kippur service, and we were walking out, and, you know, people left the newspaper on the floor, so people were walking on the newspaper. So a friend of mine looked, and he happened to be walking on a newspaper that had this big headline about some personality. It was so famous, and so this, and so that. He looked, and he laughed, he said, nobody knew when that headline, when that headline was written, he must have felt so great. A month later, he lost it all. And so, an entire generation comes, an entire generation goes. It's like the waves of the sea. And it comes with a crash, and it comes forward, and it makes a big roar, and it looks like, my gosh, you know? And then all of a sudden it comes, and it just, only to recede back into the nothingness. And you thought you were a big wave, you know, and you thought this was a new wave. And it just comes up, and you know what's left? Ha'aretz lo'olam, the land's yours. You thought you made history. The only thing that's still around is the dirt that you tread upon. And we all have these moments, and they're frightening moments. Kohelet tells us, under the sun, in the light of the sun, then really it's futile. It really is nothing. It is vapors that have no substance. There's no permanence to it. A whole generation. And yet, gone. And the only thing that's left is the dirt. And I thought I was in the top of the world. And yet the only thing left is the dirt that's upon my own grave. By the way, what they say was the blessing of Hashem to Am Yisrael that you will be like the sand. Right? You'll be like the sand. So people said, what kind of bracha is that to be like the sand? Like the dirt, like afar aretz. Right? And that was it. Right? What will be afar aretz? So they say the blessing of it is that the nations of the world treaded upon us like we were dust. And yet, the dust is still here. Right? And those who equate themselves to dust and don't make themselves into, you know, Ziggy Stardust, don't think they're so big. Right? Those who equate themselves to dust are the ones that really stick around. V'zarach Hashemesh and the sun burst forward. Zarach, it shines. Uba Hashemesh, and here comes the sun. Ve'el mekomo shoef, and to its place. Yearns, Zoreach Husham, and it's shining towards it. So you get this feeling of a sunburst, not just like the masses. We're talking about the sun bursting forward, and it's dramatic, and it's exciting, and it's brilliant. Holech El Derom, and it's going up, it's going over to the south, and it's making a big turn up to the north, and you see, wow, it comes around. So Vev, Holech HaRuach, and it goes to the side, El Svivotav, Shavaruch, and come back. And you thought you were, here you are, you're coming so far, and you're going so wide, and it's such a long journey, you end at the same place. And you say, where did I, after all this, where did I end up? And so he's clearly giving a sense of the transient. He's giving a sense of the here today, gone tomorrow. He's giving a sense of the rising of the sun only to set. The coming of a generation only to go. And it makes such a big journey. And it seems to end up in the same place. It's a frightening vision, but I think we've all had this vision, where you look at your life and you say, my gosh, I came so far around, and I say to myself, my gosh, here I am again. Same place. Kol ha'nachalim holchim el hayam. All the rivers are going to the ocean. So you see all these rivers, and they're flowing, and they're rushing, and they're moving, and they've got a destiny, and it's the ocean. Vayam and in a malach, and yet the sea is not full. So you say to yourself, my gosh, after all these years, you think the sea would just keep building up, you know? And yet, there's no fulfillment. And of course, he's selecting his images. He's selecting generations, which is history. History comes and goes. It seems to repeat itself. It doesn't seem to get anywhere. The physical world, the natural world, the sun rises, but it just sets. The rivers flow forward, rushing towards a destiny, and yet when they get there, nothing seems to accumulate in the end. Ela makom she'nachlim olchim sham hem shavim. And all the places that they were going to was only really where they were returning to. Hear what he's saying? You know? I wasn't going anywhere. I was just going back. I thought I was going forward. And I really ended up. And the future ends up in the past. Kol ha'dvarim yigeim. Everything is so tiresome. You know? You get tired looking at it. It just seems like another name and another this. It's like I heard one rabbi say, the problem with history books is they look more like phone books. You know, because it's really dates and names and dates and names and dates and names. And you kind of take a moment and realize, hey, wait a second, this was a person and a life and a struggle and a... But it ends up with a place and a name. And that's what it was. Kol ha'dvarim yigeim, everything is tiresome. Lo yuchal ish l'daber. There's really nothing to talk about. You know, you have these conversations and you're talking. And, you know, you see these two people sitting on a park bench and they're talking about the world and the problems of the world and then what we're going to do and what's got to be done. And then we'll see you later, and they get together the next day and talk about the world and just see what happened, and I don't believe it. And you learn a lot. You know, sitting on a park bench and listening to the conversations of people and say, you know, didn't we have this conversation before? And you realize, my gosh, it could be a tape recorder. It could just be a tape, you know, I could play the same conversation. I remember this conversation 10 years ago. It was with a different person, it was maybe a different subject, but it was the same. So kol ha'dvarim, all the words are yayim, you know. Lo yuchal ish l'daber. There's really nothing to say. Lo tisba'ayim lirot. My eyes are not satisfied because I've seen this before. Lo timaleh ozen mishmoa. And the ear is not filled to hear. I've heard it before. I've seen it before. I said it before. It was said before. What's the point? What's the point? Ma shahaya. Who she had. That which was is going to be. And this is fatal. You know, this is fatalism. Nothing new, nothing. What was is going to be. The future is only really the unfolding of the past. It was all told. And this is another implication of the whole idea of what meaning is there under the sun. Because some commentaries see under the sun as a metaphor for astrology. If you live under the world of Mazel, if you live under the world of constellations, if you live under the world of astrology, then it's all fated, it's all predicted, it's all was, and that's what's going to be. Mashaya ushiyeh, mashinaseh, that which was done, hushiyeh aseh, is there really anything, ve'ein kol chadash, there's really nothing new, you thought it was new, oh wow, this is a new experience, and you're like, nothing new. Tachat Hashemesh. Under the sun, there's nothing new. We live in a world that's cyclical, repetitive, just goes back. The rivers flow forward only to really flow backwards. The generation comes only to go. And it's powerful. And all that. Tachat Hashem. Under the sun. If that is the breadth of your vision, if that's the light of your life, these are the conclusions that everyone will come to, you know. Instead of the sun, tachat could mean in substitute of the sun. And therefore the metaphor of the sun here is tova. Okay? Tova. Shemesh is tova. And therefore, another way of reading Koheles is he's saying, what advantage does a person have in his labor instead of the sun? Now, the only thing that's really worth laboring at is the Torah. Everything else, really, what will I really get? So that's another implication over here. And so not only Tachat Hashem, there's nothing new under the sun, but rather instead of the sun, there's nothing new. And Rashi says a beautiful idea. The notion of originality and true creativity, Judaism claims, only exists in the realm of Torah. Because only in the realm of Torah are you dealing with the possibility of revelation from beyond what is. Right? Science is only churning over and reformulating in different ways, but what's here? I've got a limited amount to work with. You know what I mean? There's just so much new that I could come up with, new combinations of the same old stuff. Ultimately, it becomes repetitive. Okay? But when you're talking about Torah, when you're talking about receiving revelations from beyond time, beyond space, and that's another idea that Torah claims, that true creativity only exists within the realm of Torah, within the realm of revelation, right? Logic can only chew over and over the same stuff, but to get a new taste out of something. So Vein Kol Chadash Tachat Hashem, there's really nothing new, and that's what, you know, they keep telling us, because everybody wants new. That's what, you know, it's just like the elixir of life, and so they'll say new improved, new this, new that, new this, new that. And you discover that the new, within seconds, is already ours. You can't stay new, you know? And you're so excited, you got this new car, and within a second someone scratches your new car. Ah, can't believe it. It's not new anymore. And so we have this continual rush, request for the new. And yet nothing really stays new. Before you know it, it is really, really old. And this is really the dilemma of our generation. Because technology has promised us something new, you know? Every politician has promised us something new is going to happen. And you look at it, there's really nothing happened. Nothing happened. So you know, you should lie and you get the chance to watch every couple of months there's a new video, right? People used to come schlepping these big videos on their backs. It was heavy, it was burdensome. Yeah. A couple months later, they got this big thing on their shoulder. A couple months later, they got this little thing on their hands. Right? Soon they'll have something affixed to their glasses. Right? And you realize that you put so much money into this new camera that has all the most original, improved features. And then before you know it, it's hard to find the film to even fool this camera because it's, you know, and you feel so good. Right? Because technology and the commercial world knows that our quest is for the new, the original, the creative, the exciting, the fresh, right? And yet, there's nothing new under the sun. In the world of nature, it just repeats itself. It just goes in circles. Under the sun. Beyond the sun's another story. And even the under the sun takes on a whole new meaning when you put it into the context of the beyond the sun. If you're stuck under the sun, this is what we feel. But if we can get beyond the sun and see even that which is within time, within the context of eternity, that which is within space, within the context of the spaceless, the infinite, that which is material within the context of the spiritual, that which is physical within the context of the spiritual, and that which is natural within the context of the supernatural. And everything takes on a whole new meaning. New all the time. So the Talmud says there's nothing new under the sun, but beyond the sun, it's always new. It's only new. It's Devar Siomar Re'eze Chadash. There's something that a person says, oh, look, it's new. Hukvar Haya. It already was. Le'olamim Asher Haya Milafanein. And so King Solomon paints a picture of such disappointment. You know, I have this moment. There's nothing new, but then I always hope there will be something new. I say, hey, that's new. Oh, yeah, that's old too. That's old too. And so it's not only the facts, but it's the expectation that things will be different and the disillusionment to realize it wasn't different either. It wasn't different either. Ein zikaron l'rishonim. So now you're hoping maybe, maybe there's nothing new, but maybe there's, you know, something in the old. How about that? Something long-lasting to the old. Okay, well, we'll forget about the new, because the new just puffs away. It's not really new. Okay, so let's look at the old. Ein zikaron l'rishonim. There's no memory to the early ones. The old, that's forgotten. Right? The new dissipates in seconds. The old is forgotten. You can't wait for the future. You live with anticipation. This, when I get there, it'll be new, it'll be fresh, it'll be exciting. You get there, you're already there. You're already thinking of the new that's going to be in the future. So you start, you know, and this is how people swing in this pendulum of life. They either put their faith in the future, you know, and their values are what this new thing that's just about to happen, or they put their faith in the past, and they keep talking about the past and the good old days, and, you know, and they hold up their trophy and they hold up their pictures and they... But who will remember that 10-pound fish that I lingered with? Who's going to cherish that trophy that I, you know, it'll be collecting dust in my children's attic. So what is it? Ein zikaron l'rishonim. There's no memory to the earlier ones. V'gam l'achronim shiyu. And even the later ones that will be lo yelehem zikaron. They too will have no memory. Im shiyu l'achronah. Right? It with those who will be after them. You know, so the early ones are not remembered by the later ones, and the later ones won't be remembered by the later ones after them. So we can try to make history. You know? Don't try and make history. Because what will it really be in the end? This, of course, is when you see it only within the confines of the under the sun. Under the sun, I'll maybe be mentioned, maybe, a line in a history book, on a shelf of history books, in the library, on microfilm, and some strange person who wants to write a PhD might try and, you know, really... When you look at yourself and your life in the light of time, in the light of history, in the light of technology, in the light of everything else that so unfortunately people think is and use as their only light to view themselves, their world, the society, their life. Ein zikaron l'rishonim. There's no memory to the past. It's just gone. You know, it's just gone. It's like it was the shocking experience I had the other day when my parents brought a tape of my bar mitzvah. You know, and so it was really funny, you know, you hear a tape of your bar mitzvah, and it's really funny, but then you realize, you know, I don't even remember saying that, you know, I don't remember saying some of it, I did remember, but I remembered, I got into that moment, and I felt like I was, wow, this is the most important day of my life, I'm the king, I'm so special, you know, I remember I started to envision the banquet and the band and then the bar mitzvah boy, and I walked in and then they said, and now we're going to call upon all of David's friends to light the candle. And I said, I don't even know these people anymore. If I see them on the street, I wouldn't recognize these people. But some of them were my closest of closest friends, my intimate, you know, I shared. And you look at it and you say, where is it? And so when you look at things within time, you know, so you really can get very depressed, right? It's very depressing because it's only under, right? If you see it only under the light of the sun, then these are the kinds of conclusions we feel. Because the light of the sun is the light of nature, it's the light of science, it's the light of history. It's this objective light. Right? And you know, I've mentioned it before, when you look at things objectively, they just seem to lose their value. You know? And we have to be so careful not to be too objective, too removed, too aloof, too much viewing it from a distance. You know, as we mentioned the other night, if you view the Hasidim as they're dancing from a distance, so they are going in a circle, and you're wondering why they're not nauseous and dizzy by now, and they're doing the same song, and they're singing the same song, and they're dancing the same step over and over again. You say to yourself, you're crazy, because you're looking at it in the light of the room. Right? In the light of this objective aloofness, but if you jump in and you dance with them, and you feel it with the light of spirit, the light of holiness, the light of God, and you realize that it was never ending up in the same place, it was really a spiral, and every time they would sing that song, it would never come back to the same place. So I know people, you know, Shabbos, they sit there, they listen to, you know, they've never had a Shabbos experience, so they hear people singing these Nigunim, these Shabbos songs. They say, well, how long can you sing the same song, you know? Come on, you know, why can't we sing another song? You keep going all around in circles and circles and circles. Only the outside of using this, you know, from the light of the sun, then it really looks stupid and it really looks silly and doesn't have much to it. And it's so repetitive and so boring. But if you jump inside and you look at it and you feel it in the light of something beyond the sun, it's so different. It's just so much more powerful. So he says, I need Koheles. I am Koheles. Right? I am the eclectic man. I am the Renaissance man. I have tasted it all. I've embraced it all. Hayiti Melech HaYisrael. B'Yushalayim. I want you to know, I want you to remind who just said all this, because you might forget who just said all this. Right? I was the king of Israel, Yushalayim. You know? And what did I do? V'natati etli bili drosh, and I gave to my heart to examine, latur, you know, to really get an overview and understanding. Right? And the Midrash says, I put together conventions of wise people. You know, we had these big conventions to talk about, you know, this and that phenomena and latour. And I systemized all kinds of logical systems and I gathered together encyclopedias. We had conventions, we had encyclopedias, libraries, b'chachma and wisdom. Al kol asher na'aseh, tachad ha-shamayim. You know, I did all this, and I really, you know, explored and researched and investigated and experimented with all that which is under the heaven. Again, tachat hashamayim, right? In this world, hu inyan ra. You know, this is evil. This is bad stuff. Natan Elohim, that God gave l'bnei Adam. The people lanosbo to afflict him. That's a very strong thing. What is he saying? What is he saying over here? He's saying, you know, I've applied myself to wisdom, logic, philosophy, you know, science, math. I really tried to figure it all out. We had conventions on life, and we had books and encyclopedias written up, and theses and PhDs. We had it all worked out. Natati et libi nidrosh. I gave over to my heart. Right? Natati et libi. I gave to my heart. Lidrosh. Gave my heart over to explore, latour, to understand, to pull it all together. B'chachma, with wisdom. Okay? Al kol asher na'aseh, everything that's under the heavens. And hu inyan ra, and this is a bad thing. Now, what is a bad thing? Now, there's two ways of reading this verse, and I think they're both equally important. The process, the endeavor, was a bad thing.
trying to figure it all out. Bad thing. Try to figure it all out. And I can tell you, I really relate, because I tried to figure it all out. You know, I tried to philosophize and understand this and that, and why this and why that and why this. And you try to do it from a logical point of view. And you're looking and you're hoping you're going to get all these logical answers and something so systematic and so rational. And you give your heart over to your mind. Right? And you deny knowing the world also through your heart. And I'm not saying be exclusive to your heart, but to give my heart over to the intellectualism of life. Very dangerous. It's a bad thing, he says. It's something that Tana Elohim Livnei Adam La'anos Bo. God gave this. Why is this in the world? It's to afflict me. It's just the affliction. So Rashi says, Kohelet says, now I understand what God said. Right? I give you Torah. When God gave the Torah, I give you good. I give you life. I give you death. I give you goodness. I give you bad. Choose life. Choose Torah. I could sit around and philosophize and intellectualize and try and figure it all out from the most rational point of view. And it got me nowhere. I tried to figure it all out. So the who, Inyan Ra, could be the endeavor to figure it all out rationally. Right. Is a bad thing. But the who could also be all this stuff under the sun. This is the bad that God was talking about. Exclusively exploring the material world, the natural world, the scientific world, and denying myself the supernatural, the spiritual, the beyond the world. And God gave man. This was God gives this to you, right? Lanos. That's one way of reading it. Another way of reading it is that, well, I don't want to confuse you with different ways of reading it, so let's stick with one way. But there are many ways to interpret it. There are many ways to interpret the text. And they're all very important. Well, the other way of understanding it, that the Chachma he's referring to is not mere rational, but he's actually referring to Torah. And that I did apply myself to Torah, and that try and understand just that which is underneath the heaven. That was a bad thing, which God gave us, not La'anospo to afflict us, but La'anospo could be to guide us. Two words, the same word can mean two completely different things. That's why it's important to really know Hebrew really well, especially in texts like this, where it's not so much a storyline, but kind of a philosophical or whatever. Ra'iti et kol ha'masim, I saw everything. And that's, you know what I mean? And he's serious. He says, I've seen it all. And, you know, there was nothing that I didn't see. And the Midrash says, what does it mean? Everything. So it says, not only did Shlomo learn Torah, they learned everything. He even knew how you sweeten mustard. You know? He said, he even knew how you make, you know, sweetened beans. Now, what was the Midrash trying to say? You ever meet these people who, like, they know how to do these little things? He's like, how do you know that? Why did you even bother to learn how to do that? You know? It's like things that seem so trivial. It's interesting, but, you know, like, it's all. But he says, I knew it all. I knew the most important. I knew even little trivialities, you know? So I knew it all. I know everything that's going on in the world. That's what's so interesting. Because King Solomon's Kohelis, most people, when they think of a rabbi, they think of a person who was only in this Beit Midrash, and he only knows, you know, the Torah, and he only knows Halacha, and he never has seen the world. And that is not King Solomon. King Solomon saw the whole world, right? He knew everything. He really enjoyed life. You think he doesn't here, but you'll see as we come up, he really had a very broad life experience, right? And that's the kind of rabbi we're all really looking for, you know? Is this Kohelis, you know? It's so delightful. It was like my friend's neighbor goes to a yeshiva here in the old city, which is a very kind of right-wing kind of yeshiva. It's a very excellent place.
And so he came home, you know, and his Rebbe, his teacher, and he says, Ima, look, look! Right? And he took out an elastic band right from his pocket and put it around his fingers, right? And he went like this and he shot it. Right? And he said, Mommy, look what I can do! He says, you know who taught me that? My Rebbe. Mm-hmm. And that was delightful. That was delightful. And so there's a passage in the Talmud that says, you don't know wisdom until you really understand what it means to be a fool. So Rabbi said, what kind of thing is that for the Torah to say? Right? So they were trying to figure this out. They went to visit another rabbi. And they walked into the house without the rabbi knowing. And they saw this great, great Torah scholar on his knees with a pencil in his mouth. And he's playing with his baby. Right? And he said, now I understand. You know, if you can't get on your knees and play with your baby, you're not a big Talmud Chacham. You're not a person who knows the wisdom of life. He said, I know it all. I know it all. Kol ha'masim shenasu tachat ha'shemesh, v'hineh ha'kol hevel ra'us ruach. Everything under the sun, and again we're talking, if you're just restricting your life vision, and your life context, and if you're looking for meaning within the theme of just the under the sun world, he says, then it's all vain and you're running after wind, chasing rainbows, is the modern way of seeing it. It's just, you're just in it up, and it just seems so powerful and it's so exciting, and if you grab it, it's nothing's there. Nothing's really there. Ma'uvas lo yuchal yitkon. And this is very interesting. That which is crooked, you can't fix. The chisaron, and that which is lacking, lo yuchal imano. That which is lacking, you won't be able to add to. Now why not? Because in the natural world, what can really be fixed if someone's really sick, you know? So nature has no compassion. Nature isn't compassionate. You walk into the doctor tells you that your liver is finished. So what are you going to say? Oh, please, Mr. Doctor, I'm sorry. I beg your forgiveness. Right? You say, well, you have transgressed the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are cold. And the laws of nature are rigid. And the laws of nature don't care about you. And so if you made a mistake in the laws of nature, well, then there's nothing you can fix. And that's what's so sad about living in the under-the-sun world. There's no room for tshuva. There's no room for changing, really changing. You make a mistake, there's nothing I can say. Say you're sorry. Say you're sorry as the tornado rips up your house. What can you say to nature? You can't say anything. Barti ani im libi. I spoke with my heart, Lomar, saying, Ani hinei yigdalti v'osafti chachma. Look at me, I grew and I added wisdom. Al kol asher hayah lefanai el Yerushalayim. I was the smartest, most brilliant. I had every single PhD you could imagine. I read every single philosopher and I added it. V'libi ra'ar bechachma v'dat. I have seen everything. I've read every book on the topic, every philosopher, everything. That Neli be, and I gave my heart over, Vedat Chachma, Vedat Halalus. And not only that, I gave my heart over not only to know wisdom, I even gave my heart over to know folly and insanity. Right? Which might mean that I not only explore the external world, but I explore the psychological world. And I think Freud started off by basically, you know, investigating the insane, you know? And so I tried to understand the world and the inner world of man, the outer world of man, and the Yadati, and who knows, you know, I mean, for modern people it might be psychedelics. You know, I'm sure that's not what he did, but you know, I gave my heart over to understanding wisdom, and I gave my heart over to understanding folly. Yadati shizgav zev urayom ruach, and I understood that all this was just wind. It was all just wind.
What is
folly and craziness, foolishness. Okay, Ki barov chachma, because the more you know, rav kas, the more angry you get. V'yosif dat, the more knowledge you add, yosif mechol, right? The more pain you add. Now, of course, you have to be very careful because he's talking about the under the sun kind of wisdom, right? The under the sun world. And he says, the more you know, the more you wish you didn't know, you know? And the more you understand, the more you start to wish you didn't understand. And the more you have wisdom, the more angry you get. Because you realize that you cannot figure it all out. You just cannot figure it all out if the only world you're trying to figure out is under the sun, and the only light you're using to figure it out is the under the sun. And of course, from the Jewish point of view, his answer is, it's only in the light of the supernatural, in the light of the revealed, in the light of Torah, will things have meaning. But not necessarily as you're going to say it'll all make sense, right? But that's the problem. Don't try and make sense out of it. But there's a way of knowing something, there's a way of appreciating something, there's a way of enjoying something, even though it might not make sense.
Can you give like practical example of...
Well, I think when two people are in love, and they're really, really in love, and they say, you know, but this doesn't make sense, you know, and I don't know how I'm going to make a living, and you don't know how you're going to make a living, and but you know, in the world of love, somehow, even if it doesn't make sense, there's a way to work it out. Even if it's not rational. You know, there are certain things that are meaningful, even though they just don't seem rational. And one of those things is love. Love is not rational. To share your life with another person isn't so rational. To give of yourself to another and to endeavor and engage in a life endeavor of self-sacrifice for your children, it doesn't make sense. Thank God. People are stupid, you know? We do things that sometimes don't make sense. But there's great meaning to it, because I can't rationally explain to you, but why do you force me to measure things only according to the rational? And I'm not denying the importance of the rational, but only the rational, exclusively the rational, to see things only in the light of science, only in the light of physical, only in the light of the sun, won't be enough. It won't be enough.
Does that mean that you didn't really think it out?
No, it's because you've expected to understand it by thinking it out alone. And there's more to it than thinking it out. Just feeling it out and tuning it out. And of course, with total respect for the thinking of it out. But when a person views life exclusively rational, then they become entangled in the web, you know, of logic. And there's a world that is beyond the natural logical world. And so, you know, one of the reasons why people have such difficulty believing in God is because they're trying to figure God out. But God says, my mind is not like yours, and my ways is not like yours. So stop trying to figure me out. Stop trying to figure me out. And just accept the reality, the experience, the encounter. Even if I can't make sense of it, that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Is the only thing I'm going to acknowledge really happened, is the only thing that I can make sense of? There's a lot of things that happen in my life that don't make sense, but they happen. They happen. You know, surely miracles don't make sense. So a rational person has a difficult time believing in miracles, right? Because it doesn't make sense. But who says that the world has to make sense? Who says that the world has to accord itself to the rigid laws of nature? A miracle could happen. Or your perceptions of the laws of nature. And so we've narrowed ourselves so down.
and we've secluded ourselves, and we have bound ourselves to ways of understanding the world only through our rational minds, only through our left brains, and we've denied our right brains. And okay, and this is only really the beginning. It's kind of harsh beginning, of course. He does have resolve, but he does go back and forth, because that is life. That's the dance of life. It swings, between these moments of intense, doubt and pain and anger and confusion, and then just something crystal clear comes through. But that's okay. But it's precisely that dialectic where the ultimate clarity lies.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.